Now, In Depth with Francis Rose.
Thank you very much for listening on Friday, August 29th, 2014. It's the Federal News Countdown, the three most important federal news stories of the week. Each week, two experts in the world of the federal government choose the news stories they think are most important to people who work in the federal government. They rank them in order from number three to number one, and they come into the studio and we count them down on the Federal News Countdown. This week, my experts counting them down are David Olive of Catalyst Partners. It is great to see you, my friend. Thanks for coming in today.
Glad to be here, Francis.
And Dan Chenick of the IBM Center for the Business of Government and chairman of the Industry Advisory Council, IAC. And I'm pumped already for ELC 2014.
Great, Francis. Thanks. Good to hear.
I am looking forward already to coming down there and helping out with some of the sessions or whatever it is that that you want me to do.
It's a pretty good way to weasel yourself into an introduction and an invitation, isn't it?
Yeah, I do whatever I can to help.
We're looking forward to seeing you, Francis.
I do what I can to help. We start where we always start, gentlemen, with
number three.
And David Olive's choice for the third most important federal news story of the week from the National Journal. The headline is "Federal Deficit Set to Rise Sharply, CBO Warns." And when you sent your stories over, you indicated that this is on your radar screen, not so much for the deficit number as for a bigger picture, right, David?
Correct. And it is because the story comes precisely as Congress comes back to look at what to do with the FY15 budget, whether they're going to do a full-blown omnibus CR, how long that CR will go, whether it will go beyond December, put it in a lame duck. We get into the question of sequestration. There have been a number of stories this week saying that government shutdown whispers are beginning to occur. So you put all of that in this environment, and you lay the CBO report, leaked very quietly, I think, on Wednesday of this week, that says that the percentage of the federal government budget or the deficit is going to go from about 39% up to about 77%. And if there's anything that puts handcuffs and leg irons on members of Congress and on the administration, that warning is going to do it. So that's why it made my number three. I will tell you, it was a very tough decision to get this one because the last week of August is supposed to be a very quiet week when people are out of town. But we had an earthquake on Sunday. We had the funeral in Ferguson raising the issue of militarization of local police forces. We had the president wearing a tan suit that got all kinds of
which I thought was a great
coverage.
Suit.
Apparently he did, too. Well, best tweet I saw on that was, it's called The Audacity of Taupe.
Yeah, I saw that, too.
You've got Hello Kitty being, all the now kids know that it's not even a cat. And I understand there was a big fire call out in rural Maryland when a certain radio host celebrated a birthday this week.
That's yeah, right. I heard that, too.
So, you know, there was so much to choose from.
I can't imagine who you'd be talking about. Here's what's troubling in your story, Dave. Billy House writes in the National Journal, the main causes of the deficit increase, a rise in Social Security spending for an aging population, expansion of federal subsidies for health insurance, and the growing interest payments on the federal debt. None of those are things that are that Congress has given any indication that they want to touch in any way. They're focused on the discretionary budget and not on these things that are musts.
I think that it's the elephant in the room. Clearly, there have been a lot of people who have talked around the edges. But coming into a midterm election, what House points out in his story is that this year the deficit is coming down. So you hear all of the rhetoric being around, oh, look, we're reducing the deficit. And the CBO is putting up a big warning flag saying, hang on, this is not the story. The real story is what you just pointed out.
David's third most important federal news story of the week from the National Journal. The headline is Federal Deficit Set to Rise Sharply. CBO warns the total that they are saying is $960 billion by 2024. Dan Chenick's third most important federal news story of the week from the Fed Times. The headline is Collaboration is the New Normal for Networks. And it strikes me that there are implications there that people aren't thinking about. It's not just federal agencies. It's probably the private sector, too.
Yeah, this is really an indication as much for what it says about the direction of technology, both across the government and in the commercial space, as for the progress the DoD is making specifically that the article pointed out. And so that's why I thought it was interesting, because it talked about as much of the roadmap toward enterprise collaboration is about partnerships, creating team-based efforts across organizational boundaries. So it's really about leading in a networked world and leading technology, because the direction of technology, of course, is that it permeates organizational boundaries itself. So you have to set up a governance structure to provide that in an organization that traditionally has had very much of a boundaried type approach.
Mm-hmm. What do you think of the tack that Terry Halverson is taking to put a task force together? I mean, everybody's wary of task forces, I guess, now in Washington, because there's about a gajillion of them. But that's the approach that he's taking. Let's put together a task force. Let's figure out what the next steps are in that holistic mm-hmm. kind of joint environment.
Yeah, I don't know how else you get something like this done. I think in industry, you've seen this when corporations have looked across complex enterprises. Mm-hmm. In governments, you've seen this working both across agencies, and successful interagency initiatives take carefully chosen people and people who volunteer, bring them together, and create value that wouldn't have been seen if they were only wearing their organizational hats. So mm-hmm. I think that Terry Halverson's strategy here is one that other agencies can learn from and mirror.
Do you think we might be far enough along now, too, in the joint environment conceptually and culturally, that those kinds of roadblocks that we might have seen in the past, where the branches were siloed and everybody wanted to do their own thing, might we be out of that age of parochialism now, where the branches are more willing and, in fact, maybe eager to think across those kinds of boundaries?
So I would say two things. It's human nature to be associated with the organization that one is in.
Sure.
Because you're with them every day. Mm-hmm. That gets reinforced by budget lines, by culture, by different types of power structures. But the visibility and the power that technology and even things like cloud computing or distributed analytics, where you're able to use technology to look across boundaries in ways that you could never have dreamed about 5 years ago, show that if you continue to sort of act in a very organizationally siloed fashion, you don't get nearly the return, and so your organization loses. Mm-hmm. And so by behaving this way and by taking advantage of these more cross-cutting technological steps, you can actually benefit your own organization by thinking. It's sort of a think globally, act locally. It's kind of a combination of those two.
And it strikes me that part of that might be generational too, because over a period of time, people who think collaboratively and think in a networked way brain-wise will want to work that way, and you know, if you're coming out of the one of the academies today, and you're going to be at the 2-star, 3-star, 4-star level in what 10, 15, mm-hmm. 20 years, you're going to be of the mindset of, this is just the nature of things. It's how we've always done a collaboration, and it just so happens we're doing it in a warfighting environment.
I think that's right, and I think you're seeing it also in the civilian workforce, where you've got more cross-agency service provision types of entities like 18F or OMB's new digital service, mm-hmm. where they're really looking at bringing in young, talented individuals, and I think the same is true in the military. Young, talented individuals don't want to sort of think about the organizations of 10 years ago. They want to think about how we can create value tomorrow, taking advantage of the technology that they work with every day.
Dan Chanuk's choice for the third most important federal news story of the week is from the Federal Times. The headline is, Collaboration is the New Normal for Networks. You can find it and all of the stories on this week's Federal News Countdown, as selected by Dan and by David Olive, at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. When we come back, the second most important federal news stories of the week on the Federal News Countdown.
This week's IT Enterprise Report is brought to you by General Dynamics Information Technology.
Plans for the 11th annual Cybersecurity Awareness Month are underway at the Homeland Security Department. DHS will partner up with the National Cybersecurity Alliance to offer different events each week catered to federal agencies, private individuals, and private companies. Week 1 will focus on the basics of cybersecurity and will feature advice from the Homeland Security Department's Stop, Think, Connect initiative. Starting in Week 2, the topics get a little more specific. You can learn about how to develop more secure IT products, including cloud systems. And in Week 4, the theme is cybersecurity for small and medium-sized businesses. DHS and the National Cybersecurity Alliance hope the outreach will strengthen and build cybersecurity best practices for both private companies and federal agencies.
General Dynamics IT, providing secure federal cloud solutions. Avoid lock-in and migrate intelligently with a trusted partner who can deliver your enterprise as a service. GDIT.com/cloud.
Here's Kimberly Hancher, CIO at EEOC, on the future state of government data centers, sponsored by NetApp and Avnet Government Solutions.
So we established a replicated environment for disaster recovery, and now we're planning to actually move the hosting of our mission systems to the cloud. And that's something that we will be doing over the next 6 months.
To listen to the whole program, log on to federalnewsradio.com.
Data center consolidation, shared services, Cloud First, and FedRAMP are forever changing the way agencies view their computing environments. The future state of government data centers classifies and prioritizes workloads based on mission performance, and value requirements are met through the creation of shared, dedicated, performance, and cloud-based infrastructures. In this state, agencies are able to achieve their missions and meet their requirements. Learn how NetApp solutions help agencies support this new state. Visit NetApp.com.
When you do all your activities, the IP address they see is the IP address of the proxy server. Because you see, it's called a proxy server because you send the request to that server and it actually makes the web request on your behalf. The website that's being contacted actually only sees the IP address of the proxy server. There are some proxy server systems that are designed to really be super anonymous, so they'll even hide your identity even further.
Stratford University's Tech Talk Radio, Saturday mornings from 9 to 10 on 1500 AM.
Lean Six Sigma has been around a long time, but what are the results for federal programs and agencies? Republican Congressman Tom Latham and Democratic Congressman Henry Cuellar are sponsoring new legislation to boost process improvement efforts. On September 9th, you have a rare opportunity to join them and process improvement experts from across government in a Capitol Hill event to discuss what their bill means for agencies. Sponsored by the National Academy of Public Administration and Federal News Radio, to sign up, visit NapaWash.org or email rcodat@NapaWash.org.
Thanks for listening to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio. The Federal News Countdown this week features the three most important federal news stories of the week as selected by Dan Chenick and Dave Olive. And we are up two on the countdown.
Number two.
The second most important federal news story of the week as selected by David Olive is from Fox Business. And the headline is Sophisticated Bank Cyber Attack Said to Target Core Infrastructure. And this is what people have been warning about, both inside government and out of government, for a long time. This is the kind of thing that hackers, this amorphous group of people, is going to try to pull off. And some experts saying this isn't a normal cyber attack. This is a big deal. This might even be organized by a nation state or something on that level. It's really huge, Dave.
That's what certainly got my attention. And when the story came out on Wednesday, it was reported by multiple media sources that J.P. Morgan Chase had been attacked by Russian hackers in mid-August. The belief was that it came at about the same time as the administration was announcing new sanctions against the Russians because of the situation in Ukraine, because of other things that were going on. And so there appeared to be this retaliatory strike at what some of the commentators called the gold standard of cybersecurity, which was the financial services industry. Just this morning, after we had submitted our stories, Francis, the financial services ISAC came out and said, well, there was nothing special that occurred this week or this month. This is normal. We are constantly under attack. Whichever story is correct, it points out the sheer vulnerability. And the real issue here is, what do our enemies, both military, political, and economic competitors, do to undermine trust in our systems? Because if people did not have trust in the physical banks that they go have their accounts in, they would not do banking in that way. You wouldn't go to the grocery store if you didn't have trust in the quality of the food. So if the enemies can attack the cyber infrastructure in a way to destroy trust, this makes a huge difference in the way the public perceives cyber attack and how we respond. For me, it's part of the overall issue of how do we deal with the threats that we are now seeing from Russia that for years we thought the Cold War was over. We see it in Ukraine with the physical incursion. What is the administration going to recommend that we do? What should private industry do? How do we deal with the trade issue if there's embargoes and restrictions with all the U.S. business interests? And then you overlay it with this cyber attack or the continuing series of attacks, which look like they're state-sponsored, or at least there's a benign neglect. And it becomes a very, very important issue and one that I think needs far more attention than it's gotten this far.
It's real easy to jump to the Russia conclusion, especially given their pattern in the past of having done the same thing right before military operations in Georgia, I believe it was, in 2009.
Right. And I think it generally points out the risk of the interplay between the physical domain and the cyber domain from a military perspective, and the fact that we don't really have norms, international norms, about how to understand and how to respond when a nation state or a non-nation state actor, like a terrorist group, employs a cyber channel to inflict harm. So we know that there's a risk. We know that there's lots of breaches on large scale. I think a few weeks ago, there was a 1.2 billion record breach that was attributed to Russian nationals. What we don't have is an accepted understanding of the response vector, if you will. How does the U.S., from a technical perspective, how do you target the attacker in that case? And then from a legal perspective, what are the rules of the road in terms of how to proceed there? And we've talked about that in the cyber world, but we really haven't, as a legal matter involving the courts and sort of the more mainstream elements of our legal system, haven't really taken that on in a serious way. And I think it points out the need to do so.
You know, even when the Justice Department indicted the Chinese a few months back, allegedly laying out the evidence of here's who did it, here's how they did it, here's the IP addresses and so forth, the number of attacks increased exponentially against very vulnerable targets. And there is a concern that if we do take some action in response to these hits, that we may not be prepared for the next move. There's a great article this week in the Chief Security Officer magazine about the mindset of the Russian hackers that Trend Micro says they are easily 4 and 5 steps ahead of the way we think about things because they approach it like a Gary Kasparov would approach a chess match. And they're looking 5 and 6 moves ahead, and they're incredibly strategic in their thoughts. And we as a society just simply don't view things that way, and maybe we need to.
One thing I will say is that corporate and government networks get penetrated and probed all the time, dozens if not hundreds of times every day. And there are really talented people in those agencies and across the commercial space who are trying their hardest to work with their teams to combat. The problem is that the sophistication, as David just said, the sophistication of the threats often outpaces our technical ability to deploy the various means to protect those networks. And so you get into a cycle where despite your best efforts, there's those one or two really large-scale things that can come over the fence that you haven't been able to put up a wall high enough or been able to provide a resiliency strategy, and that becomes the story. And so it's as much to some extent, there's resiliency that needs to be built into the networks because you know you're going to have people that are going to be able to throw balls over the top of the fence. How do you respond when that occurs, because they're always going to be able to throw a little higher than you've just built the fence.
We just have a minute or so left for this story, but we still have an attribution problem too.
Correct.
Especially in a war zone like this, because it's one thing to go and do the indictment and lay out your case, as the Justice Department did with the Chinese that you mentioned a moment ago. But certainly if we think this is a situation that's brought about because of Ukraine, Dan, you can't go and do that and expect that you're gonna that everybody's just gonna say, well, okay, that's fine, and there's not going to be some kind of retaliation or some kind of response from the other side.
Yeah, attribution is very difficult in a world where you can mask across many countries, many servers, many users, and it complicates the legal picture that we discussed a couple of minutes ago.
I think that's probably the biggest issue is the folks in the intelligence community say, well, we'll tell you what happened. And we'll give you an indication of where it came from, but we can't give you the attribution things that you really want because that impacts national security interest. And so we need a cyber bill.
David Olive's second most important federal news story of the week is from Fox Business. Sophisticated bank cyber attack said to target core infrastructure. Dan Chenick, your choice at number two this week is from NextGov. The headline is DHS official says create a government-wide seal of approval for apps. I understand enough of what goes on app-wise inside the government to understand why we haven't gotten there yet. But when Bobby Stemfley said this week, my thought was, well, of course. Why? I am a little surprised maybe that we're just getting to this point in August of 2014.
Right. So agencies, the government's always a little bit behind the curve, if you will, in terms of the leading edge in technology, except, of course, in high-end research, the DARPA funds. So the app revolution that's really cut across much of the commercial space and how we live our life is still in its earlier stages, I think, in government. And so agencies are experimenting. There are app stores in different agencies. But they're coming up and kind of bringing this forward in different programs in different ways. One of the benefits that FedRAMP did for cloud computing, the FedRAMP program, which really allows companies and agencies to get approval for security at one agency and then carry that across to others so you don't have to recreate that process. That showed that you can take something that is a common function across agencies and have a system or a process of approving that function that multiple agencies can use. And what Bobby Stemfley talked about was let's do that for apps so that as agencies put together stuff that's really useful, whether it's in the defense space, the cyberspace, or the civilian space, agencies can take advantage of those apps without having to kind of build up the whole certification, accreditation, approval process one by one.
I think this concept makes a lot of sense. As I said, my only question about it was, why haven't we gone there yet? What the question that I've had that still hasn't been answered is, why do different agencies need to have their own app stores? GSA has the structure available already. They've built it. And they're having a heck of a time trying to get agencies to come participate because everybody wants to build their own. I don't see. Is there a case for doing that as opposed to a case for utilizing something that somebody else has already done?
Well, this almost is a political science issue. The way that agencies start to do programs comes up from the budgets and appropriations and programmatic lines that are in statutes that govern their own stuff. Mm-hmm. So that's why agencies built all their own payroll systems. And you had, you know,
because Congress gave them money
systems
to do it instead of to go buy the service somewhere.
And so 12 years ago, when I was still at OMB, we basically, you know, implemented the policy of let's consolidate payroll. And now you've got, I think, four, and, you know, maybe someday it'll be fewer. So agencies typically start to build and experiment, and that actually can be a good thing. You can have agencies try different things. At a certain point in the life cycle, you can bring it together. I know that GSA has a program where they have an app store that agencies can take advantage of, and you've pointed out, Francis. And that can be a home for once agencies experiment and sort of get beyond the beta, GSA can then take that and maybe promote it as part of the app store.
Is there any other thing that we're not thinking of, David, about why an agency would want to go off and build their own?
Well, they don't trust the other agency to know what their specific needs are, and everybody wants to tweak it. So instead of having what is known as commercial off the shelf, what they really want is customized off the shelf. They want it to be, you know, standardized so that it's ease of use, that it's secure, but they want it for their specific purpose, and consequently, nobody understands their business as well as they do. And you get this problem that once you send it into the intergovernmental agency review or you get it at OMB, it gets at such a level that it just doesn't get done. So the agency says, this is a small thing. It's our budget. We're going to go do it. And then if somebody likes our stuff, they can come get it from us.
And that's driving people in the administration crazy because they see plenty of opportunities to save money This is the whole point of the shared services and strategic sourcing idea. Initiatives. That's the whole idea behind
it. And the progress that we've made on shared services, and in fact, you mentioned my ACT-IAC role. Mm-hmm. So we're having a shared services forum in a couple of weeks where a lot of government people that are interested in that will talk about sort of the next steps in that evolution of that concept. That, I hope, is changing a little bit of the mindset. And so it will make it easier to do kind of multiple agency apps, which are really, you know, have become the way that people do business in the commercial world. Let's hope that this becomes the way that the government does business.
When is your event?
September 16th.
Where is it going to be?
It's going to be at the Grand Hyatt in downtown.
I love plugs. If there's something you want to plug later in the program,
just... I'm just going to wish you a happy birthday.
Well, I'll take that. We'll do that later
Indeed. On. Indeed. Ditto.
Thank you very much. Dan Chenick's choice for the second most important federal news story of the week is from NextGov. The headline is DHS official says create a government-wide seal of approval for apps. You can find it and all of our stories on this week's countdown at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth later this afternoon. When we come back, the most important federal news stories of the week, we get to the top of the chart on the Federal News Countdown.
This is John Gilroy from Fed Tech Talk. Wanted to tell you about a local company that has had a national impact on airline safety. For the past three decades, Electromech has worked with federal agencies to make sure aircraft wiring is safe and reliable. Electromech is responsible for testing, inspecting, and analyzing a wide range of electrical wire interconnect systems. For a white paper on addressing fleet management needs, please visit electromech.com. That's electromec.com.
Our federal employees have played an important role in upholding our nation's values and beliefs. GEICO would like to recognize their contributions and wish all federal employees and their families a very happy and safe Labor Day weekend. For over 75 years, GEICO's been helping federal employees save money on their car insurance, and they'd like to do the same for you. So if you're a federal employee or belong to a federal association like BIG, FLIOA, or NARF, find out how much you could save with a federal employee discount. Don't wait. Go to GEICO.com today or call 1-800-947-AUTO to get a fast, free rate quote. That's GEICO.com or call 1-800-947-AUTO. Keep all your weekends safe and get peace of mind with GEICO Auto Insurance. GEICO. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance. Here's Todd Meyer, senior architect at the NGA and chair to the Geospatial Integration Joint Leadership Venture Network, on the Federal Executive Forum on Big Data, sponsored by Carahsoft.
Yeah, so visualization is key. NGA is setting the path to establish one of our forward-leading programs, a map of the world, to present for the entire community down to first responders across the board for authoritative geospatial data.
To listen to the whole program made possible by the Trezza Media Group, log on to federalnewsradio.com.
The big data portfolio at Carahsoft includes industry-leading and emerging technology solutions to enable government agencies to derive more value from the increasingly massive and complex amounts of data they collect, store, and analyze. These solutions by Cloudera, Thetis, MarkLogic, and many more address the government's most pressing big data challenges, from analytics, visualization, storage, and retrieval to data consolidation, management, and compliance. Learn more at governmentitplaybook.com or email bigdata@carahsoft.com.
This hour of news is brought to you by Boeing, delivering the enduring capability and value of the F-A-18 Super Hornet to the United States Navy on schedule and on budget.
Newsmakers on In Depth with Francis Rose.
Lana Breutman, the outgoing Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Manufacturing and Industrial Base Policy.
For the first time, I'm told MIBP represented industry in a DMAG, and we were able to get funding for investments into industry. So we gained a seat at the table that was equal to other evaluations of major programs. So that really put the industrial base on the map within the DoD structure.
Hear the entire interview online, federalnewsradio.com/in-depth.
Welcome back to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. This week's Federal News Countdown features the three most important federal news stories of the week, as selected this week by Dan Chenick and by David Olive, and we are up to
number one.
The most important federal news story of the week, as selected by David Olive, is from Defense One. It's Kevin Barron's story, headlined, "Obama Says We Don't Have a Strategy Yet." And Dave, as somebody who does this for a living, I think I have a pretty good sense now of when I watch somebody else speaking in a broadcast environment and can see them say something that as soon as it comes out of his or her mouth, that person thinks, that's not what I wanted to say. That's not what I intended to say. And I saw a little bit of that, I think, come out on President Obama's face when he said this yesterday. Is that fair on my part, do you think?
I think it's absolutely fair. And I'm sure that if the president were given 9 other times to answer the same question, that he would not answer it in precisely the same way that he did yesterday. The reason this made my number one story was not because of the, if you will, the gaffe in "we don't have a strategy," but the fact that it plays directly into the entire week-long series of stories on the U.S. response to the atrocities that the ISIL group in Iraq, in Syria, are doing, the beheading of the journalists, the killing of 2 U.S. citizens who have from Minneapolis who have gone over to fight on behalf of ISIL. This is a major mess.
Mm-hmm.
And how we portray our response to that is going to depend on actions that not just our government, but the rest of the world will view us as in a leadership position. So it's not the gaffe as much as it is the underlying story. We have got to face up with the fact that, as Dan said earlier, this is a group that does not play by any recognized international norms whatsoever. It is contrary to everything that we stand for as a matter of policy and as a people. And we are not able to deal with that. And when the White House was given the opportunity, at least to convey the message, we are seriously working on it, what came across was we're in a state of confusion. And I think that's something that's going to continue to create interest as Congress gets back into town and as the White House gets its act together and the message becomes more clear.
It's striking to me that we've seen as much discussion, I think, about people thinking that it was weird that the president had a tan suit on as they did about the contents of the news conference. I mean, and the other element here is the social media, the way social media drove this, because I was not watching the news conference yesterday, Dan, but I was on Twitter and watching my Twitter feed at the time. I bet you 30 people that I follow tweeted Obama colon and then some form of this quote that's in the headline of this piece in Defense One. We don't have a strategy yet. No context, no qualification about what the question was he was responding to, just name, colon, and then some piece of that quote. And that's really unfortunate, I think, because that unfortunately becomes what drives the discussion then.
Yeah, well, I think it illustrates the immediacy of social media in terms of what gets out there and the fact that as a an operation in terms of management in any situation, providing more context quickly is important, mm-hmm. because the sooner you can sort of put context and demonstrate, you know, that, you know, this is in response to a particular question, et cetera, the more it enables you to sort of put that immediate issue to one side and to move to what's the real issue, which is, again, how to manage a multi-nation, very complex response to an international issue.
Dave just handed me a sheet that he brought with him. Some guy tweeted more than 4,000 tweets were posted about Obama's suit during the press conference. I mean, that's just...
It's the silly season.
Because I think, here's the thing, it's not like that was on TMZ or something like that people who ordinarily wouldn't be concerned about ISIL would be tuned into it and accidentally see it, and they think about suits, but they don't think about foreign policy. These are people who specifically tuned in to see the President of the United States deliver information about a major foreign policy issue. We all knew that's what the news conference was going to be about. And And we get 4,000 tweets about a suit, which I thought was a good-looking suit, by the way.
That was a good-looking suit.
The Poplin suit in Washington makes perfect sense to me at the end of
August. Makes me wonder what would have happened had Trent Lott gone on the floor of the Senate wearing his standard seersucker suit, which he wore every week of the summer, and even created a seersucker suit club in the U.S. Senate. So
they brought that back this year, by the way.
Yeah.
Which I think was a nice touch.
I think the reason it played maybe a little bit more in the Twitterverse than other is the president had just come back from Martha's Vineyard, had been playing golf, according to the Republicans, while all of these issues were going on. And it fit the narrative of someone who's not serious. Francis, I don't know that we're spending more time on the discussion probably than it deserves.
That's probably the case. The way people are talking about it and the way people are talking about what it signifies says to me that it's something that people in government should be paying attention to, because these are people who are watching the government, as I said. These are not people who just accidentally stumbled on the president's news conference. You had to go to look to see the news conference. It's not like it was accidental. And that's why this suit thing kind of sticks in my craw.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think if you look behind the immediacy of this, you'll see that there's a tremendous effort going on across the government in the White House, and that they are working very hard to develop a response and to develop a communication strategy. And these are complex, very fast-moving issues. And so, again, it shows the point of trying to address those issues in a communication strategy through social media as well as part of that evolving response.
Well, and David was talking a moment ago about the issue with the Russian hackers and how they think strategically 2, 3, 4, 5 moves ahead. And you have to do the same thing here. And that's not something that you can cook up in an hour. Now, I understand we don't have a tremendously long period of time, and we want to move as quickly as we can against people like this. To decide whatever you're going to do and then get on with it. But it's also not something you just snap your fingers and all of a sudden you have a strategy about how to defeat ISIL.
No, but there's been a lot of talk over the last year or two about the domestic terrorist threat versus the external international threat. This is the first time within a period of a week where two U.S. citizens, one who could not have had a more American name than Douglas MacArthur McCain, right, is killed fighting on behalf of ISIL. And so I think it's going to raise the issues as we approach the anniversary of 9/11, as the Brits today raise their threat level to severe, and the intelligence community report says there's increased chatter among the terrorists, the threats that ISIL has made, the alleged picture of the flag in front of the White House. There is a seriousness to all of this that I think we're going to continue to hear about. We're going to have to address, and we're going to have to address it in a way that doesn't make fun of the issue. Where we spend a lot of time talking about tan suits.
David's most important federal news story of the week is from Defense One. The headline is, Obama says we don't have a strategy yet. It's coverage of his news conference yesterday, and you can find it on federalnewsradio.com/in-depth later this afternoon. When we come back, we wrap up the Federal News Countdown with Dan Chenick's most important federal news story of the week. That's next on Federal News Radio.
It's 6:42 p.m. Time for Steve Plato and his son Dylan to do the dishes. They talk about everything from the yuckiness of girls to the awesomeness of his soccer team. Sometimes they don't talk at all. Then, hey! The dreaded splash fight. It's dad o'clock, and it's the best time of the day. Because the smallest moments can have the biggest impact on a child's life. Take time to be a dad today. Call 877-4DAD-411 or visit fatherhood.gov. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
Experts have been talking about the promise of cloud technology for some time now.
The cloud will transform how America works.
You've also heard them talk about its advantages.
The cloud will reduce government costs and improve productivity.
And you've heard this.
The cloud will deliver security across the entire platform.
Now there's a cloud that delivers on those promises. Introducing AT&T Cloud Solutions for Government. Our portfolio of solutions provides agencies the confidence that comes with the security of the AT&T network. With end-to-end integration for greater security, reliability, and performance.
Government agencies will serve the nation confidently using the cloud.
Find out how AT&T Cloud Solutions for Government can give your agency the confidence that comes only with the security of the AT&T network. Visit att.com/gov/cloud. Designed to meet FedRAMP certification. AT&T. Mobilizing your world.
Big sky country, the great plains, and now fields and fields of data. In this land of plenty, we've got an abundance of it. If you're in federal IT, your workers need reliable access to that data, and your agency expects you to protect it all, from sea to shining sea. Lucky for you, CDWG is here. We can help you create any kind of storage solution you need, virtualized, cloud, on-premises. Our experts know how to build systems flexible enough to meet your needs and safe enough to keep you at ease. So your data will be secure, your agency will stay compliant, and your workers will have access wherever they may roam. Find out more at cdwg.com/landofplenty. CDWG, people who get it.
Visit cdwg.com to learn how NetApp's storage systems and software can help you store, manage, and protect your data.
The Washington metro area has a ton of cool history around it. Marvin Bond is editor of Recreation News and resident history expert. He says the 200th anniversary of the Star Spangled Banner is right around the corner.
Well, of course, September is the 200th anniversary, but up until then, the Baltimore Harbor is full of lots of things to do. You can see what Francis Scott Key saw with a 35-minute boat tour. It goes out past Fort McHenry, or you can get a 60-minute boat tour, or, of course, Fort McHenry, which was the site of the bombardment. Get tickets to the two-hour concert and fireworks on September the 13th. You can see the whole story on page 10 of the August Recreation News or at recreationnews.com.
I have a friend, let's call him Sean, who loves war reenactments. Any ideas for him?
Over in Kent County, they're reenacting the Battle of Cawk's Field with activities like encampments, parades. You can find out more about all of this in a story on page 12 of the August Recreation News.
Marvin Bond is editor of Recreation News. I'm Nicola Grisco.
The immersion of technology in all areas of government is changing the role of the chief information officer. To be successful, CIOs must play a multidimensional leadership role, requiring them to work strategically with other government leaders to adapt and transform their enterprises. Join AFCEA Bethesda on September 10th at the Bethesda North Marriott to hear how the next generation of CIOs will transform their organizations to help fellow government leaders drive transformation across the enterprise. Register today at AFCEABethesda.org.
Like Federal News Radio on Facebook for a look at some of the top federal stories each day. Plus, we'll give you a taste of what goes on behind the scenes. Find us at facebook.com/Federal News Radio.
You're listening to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. This week's Federal News Countdown features the three most important federal news stories of the week, as selected by David Olive and Dan Chenick. And Dan's most important federal news story of the week is executive editor Jason Miller's story on federalnewsradio.com. OMB to Congress, fix 2015 budget to avoid return of limited sequester. Now, of the S words in Washington that we've dealt with budget-wise in the last couple of years, Dan, fortunately none of them with four letters, shutdown is pretty much completely off the table, at least as it appears today.
That's got a two-part four letters.
Well, that's a fair point. I hadn't thought of that, but you're right about that. We saw Paul Ryan make the rounds of the Sunday shows talking about his book, saying no shutdown from our point of view. He's the chair, of course, of the House Budget Committee. The ranking member of the Budget Committee, Chris Van Hollen, told me in an interview that's archived at federalnewsradio.com, there'll be no shutdown this year. So that one seems to be off the table. Sequester still on the table, because when we get done with fiscal 15, we're back in sequester land. The Bipartisan Budget Act is concluded at the end of fiscal 15. And Jason is writing here about OMB telling Congress, you really should look at it this year in this budget deal. To make sure that it doesn't carry over into fiscal 16.
That's right. I mean, as Jason writes about and as the OMB report to Congress points out, and it's a fairly technical point, the pre-existing caps will force defense to be to come under those caps for 2015, as the OMB report pointed out, by $34 million, which, given the entire defense budget, is not a from a percentage perspective, a huge amount. But it does trigger all of the infrastructure that goes into the sequester, and it brings back to the fore where almost in September, the fact that on September 30th we could be talking about sequestration and we don't have any of the appropriations bills signed, so we could be talking about a continuing resolution. We have heard, although they're not, you know, I don't know how credible they are, reports about attaching immigration legislation to some of the appropriations bills, which could lead to some of the, again, a return of at least the talk about a government shutdown, if not the actuality, because I agree with you that the chance of that, I think, are pretty low. But it just demonstrates that, once again, we're going to come into a season where, especially in an election year, where there's going to be lots of maneuvering around any type of lever to gain advantage, that will sort of magnify these and create a broadcast, if you will, across a political landscape that didn't exist last year because there wasn't an election. So it's these issues are going to come back in the next few weeks.
Now, you're a pretty avid Congress watcher, David. Do you see, most people are predicting when they come back next week, or week after next, actually, that they'll only have 12 days. They will have they won't get much done. They'll get the CR done, and that's about it, because nobody's talking about appropriations bills really anymore. Senator Mikulski might give it one more shot, I think, or try to, but nobody thinks that will really happen at this point. Do you believe that they will be limited to that? Or because it sounds like if they could slide an immigration bill into this and actually get it passed, or maybe some other things, they might actually be fairly productive in these 12 days.
I don't think they'll do immigration whatsoever. And I think the reason for it, I'll go back to a four-letter word, Eric, last name Cantor.
Mm-hmm.
I don't believe that immigration stands a chance of doing anything before the midterm elections in November. The CR that they will do is not that they're going to do the CR. The real open question right now is whether the House leadership can convince their members that that CR needs to go all the way out through December. There's even some talk about whether a CR will go out into March. And so the issue of timing is one that's still open. Chris Van Hollen's comment to you that there won't be a government shutdown this year, maybe talking the calendar year, because if the November elections change the control of the Senate, we're going to find a very different attitude, both in a lame duck session and the first of the year. The thing that I think makes Dan's story so interesting is that although we're still trying to worry about an omnibus, the FY15 budget, all the agencies are now in the process, as you well know, of compiling the 16 budget.
Mm-hmm.
What do they use as a guideline? What programs are they going to have? This is the last 2 years of this administration.
We've got an OMB expert.
If they're going
right
to get
here,
anything
they
done, they're going to have to get it done now. But those plans might as well be written on a whiteboard, given the certainty that is not there, I guess, if I can use a double negative.
I know they're not guessing inside OMB. They're trying to use whatever tools they have. But what do you suppose they're doing?
So there's
at this
a separation
point?
Between the high level budget numbers, and David's absolutely right. That's difficult to baseline given the multiple laws and the report that OMB gave to Congress about what could happen if sequestration occurs, and they'll have to take that into account. And the sort of the more standard budget elements in terms of programs and the management agenda. So that's standard stuff and management initiatives, cross-agency priority goals. The fact that that comes into the budget, that'll continue. The fiscal element of the budget is certainly in question. And I think that a CR, the, you know, whether there is a, you know, the form of the CR. By the way, the immigration point that I was making was not immigration reform per se. It was potential congressional reaction if the administration actually comes out with executive actions and tying that congressional reaction to,
okay,
to funding to try to take, you know, defund it, et cetera.
Yes.
You're hearing talk about that. I don't know how serious that is, because I think it's, you know, it's something that we'll have to see play out. But from a budget development perspective, the point that I think David's also pointing out is that all of the issues that we talked about that kind of have been quiet a little bit over the summer will probably come back into play, and you'll hear discussion of sequestration, continuing resolution, and it'll be complicated by the election.
I want to finish the show today with a little contest. And the winner of this contest between the two of you, I'll take you to lunch. The date that you think the final CR that President Obama signs will last through, that starts October 1st and ends whatever, the one that he signs, you pick the date.
The one that he signs before September 30th.
Correct.
So that the government
stays open. Right. But how long you think that will last?
First one.
Yes, the first one. Day?
Without knowing what day of the week is, I'm picking December the 3rd.
December 3rd, okay. And its closest one wins. So what do you think?
November 15th.
November 15th. All right, I'm writing this down, and I will make a note that the winner goes to lunch. And I think those are both good.
Does the loser buy?
No, I'll buy. So either way, you can't lose. There's no lose, except if you didn't win, you don't get invited.
And he says there's no free lunch in Washington.
I'm paying for it, but so it's not free to me, but that's all right. It was my idea in the first place. A terrific Federal News Countdown, as always, gentlemen. Thank you both for coming on. Dave, good to see you.
Very much. Good to you. And shout out to our friend Rich Cooper,
yes,
who's also celebrating a birthday today.
His birthday's today.
Right.
Yeah. The day right after, or two days after mine.
Yours.
That's amazing. Dan Chenna, great to see you, as always.
Thank you, Francis. Happy birthday.
Thank you for coming on the program today, and thanks for the birthday wishes. You can read all the stories through links we have, and you can listen to the program again at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. Have a great Labor Day weekend. In Depth with Francis Rose continues in just a moment.